Parenting doesn't come with a manual, and when your child learns differently, there's no one-size-fits-all. Here, we think out the box. We celebrate every unique mind, every different path, and every win, big or small. Welcome to Out the Box, where kids and parents grow together.
Good morning, and welcome to Out the Box. Every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., for minds that don't fit the mold and hearts that keep striving. Our word for the day, or for the week, is agency. It's so fitting for our conversation about this mainstreaming children with barriers to learning. Agency is when a child feels they have control over their learning, when they understand their strengths and are able to ask for help and believe that they're capable of success. Inclusive education is not about lowering the bar. It's about building agency. If you've ever second-guessed yourself as an advocate, as a parent, if you've ever wondered whether your child will be okay in the mainstream high school, if you're a parent who has ever sat in your car after school and cried, then this conversation is for you. As many of you know, I'm a mom of three boys, two of whom are profoundly dyslexic. They have completely different profiles, different strengths, different struggles, but both have needed scaffolding, advocacy, careful management, and a mother who believes in them, but who also gets tired and worn out. Many parents out there feel that they can't say they're exhausted. They can't say that they're burnt out. Well, I'm telling you all, and hear me, you can. You can. You're burnt out. You can say you're exhausted, because the journey of a child with barriers to learning is so difficult. It took me a really long time to be able to say without feeling guilty that I'm tired. I'm so pleased to welcome Joseph Gerassi to our conversation. Joseph is the executive head of Red Hill School, bringing decades of educational leadership experience, both locally and internationally. A passionate advocate for innovative and progressive education, he believes that the leaders of tomorrow are shaped in the classrooms of today. Beginning his career as a history teacher in 1989, Joseph remains deeply connected to students and committed to educational excellence, equity, and creativity. He is also a strong supporter of the arts, championing initiatives like the Red Hill Arts Festival to celebrate South African talent and culture. Welcome, Joseph.
Oh, thank you so much. And there's so much. We could just have this entire podcast on what you've just said.
Precisely.
Because there was so much that you had to say, you know, in your opening address, your opening remarks, that are so, so true, right? I work with parents all the time in terms of them being exhausted. It's not easy to bring up a child today, specifically if they're neurodiverse, and I use that word specifically. And teachers are exhausted, right?
Absolutely.
So we're in a profession where we're trying to do the best we can for young people so that they have the best start to life. You know, you also mentioned that it takes a strong parent to be involved. This, you can't abrogate this responsibility, but you need a partner. And I often talk about it takes a village to bring up a child. And part of that village is the schooling system. So it takes, you know, caring teachers, well-trained teachers who understand neurodiversity, parents who understand, as you said, that this is not an issue and it's not a problem, because hopefully we'll get onto some of the most incredibly talented and successful people in the world who were neurodiverse themselves and had a really tough time at school. And we could even get into school is not meant for every child. It is set up for the child that is of the norm, right? But it completely forgets it. Neurotypical. But it completely does not accommodate the child that is, you know, atypical. And it's up to schools to be able to find ways of being able to give those children, you know, access to the best education and to give them the same start in life as we give children who are, you know, who are not neurodiverse.
So collaboration is really the word that we need to use in terms of the schools, the remedial schools that children have come from, the therapists, the teachers, the parents. Yeah. And I can understand a parent's frustration, and sometimes it doesn't come across as it should. and there's sometimes anger or frustration on their part. Mm. But as a mom, all you want is for your child to be okay, to be happy.
You know, I tell a story, and maybe it's because it's 30 years of experience. You know, experience, getting old is not great, but the good thing about it is it gives you huge amounts of experience. I had a parent who phoned me once. She had her child in our school, and he was dyslexic, but not severely dyslexic. And she phoned me when her youngest son was about to come into school and said, you know, Mr. Dracy, I just need your advice. Which school should I send my child to? I said, what's wrong with your child? And she said, no, well, he's severely dyslexic. I said, so why aren't you bringing him to Redhill? And she kind of looked at, you know, I was on the phone. You got here that there was this pause of, but do you take children like this? And I said, but what is wrong with him? The only issue that you've got here is that he doesn't read the way other children read. So we give the child the tools to be able to read, and then there's not an issue, because that's the only issue that you're telling me about. Now, these are things that you've been able to diagnose early. You've spoken to me. I said, we can assist you in this way. What have we got to lose? Let's give it a shot. And she did. And both of her sons, you know, one is graduating now, I think, or just graduated. The one graduated, distinctions in maths, did really, really well. And yeah, it's exactly what you said. We got through it together. It was never the school's responsibility alone. And because she had the school to support her, it wasn't her responsibility alone.
Absolutely. But you don't feel like you're swimming upstream.
You can't. Otherwise, it's just, you know, you're never going to win that one.
There's a quiet sentence that many children carry with them. And I know that my youngest does. It's, you're not trying hard enough. But what if they are? What if the issue isn't effort, it's wiring? And if we start simply and look at the Education White Paper 6, which I never knew about, I only recently discovered it. The White Paper 6 promised inclusion. So in plain language, what does that mean for an ordinary parent listening right now?
Okay. So the first thing to understand about White Paper 6, and it was drawn up in 2001.
Correct.
So it's a long time ago, right? And if you actually ask how many of our schools are truly inclusive schools, well, we know we're close to that. So we must understand that in plain English, if my child, you know, White Paper 6 is fundamentally a shift in the philosophy in education. It was meant to be that in South Africa. And it was meant to move us away from a deficit model where a child is the problem towards a barriers to learning model where the system must examine what is preventing access. Okay, so in plain English, it means your child has a right to belong, but it's not a law.
Why isn't it a law?
Because it has to be passed by Parliament in order to become a law, and it has never been passed by Parliament.
And is there a reason for that?
Probably because of the lack of resources to make it, to actually implement it. So what it is, it's a guiding policy. Usually a white paper is put out there in order for it to eventually become a law. You know, when I worked in Australia, you know, there most of the schools are inclusive schools. I worked with severely, severely neurodiverse children that would never be allowed probably into a South African normal school, if I can put that in inverted commas. But in Australia, all schools, whether they're private schools or government schools, are heavily subsidized by the state. Mm. And every school will have a full team, you know, of experts in the school to assist. Remember, teachers were never trained in neurodiversity or how to deal with these issues. So I'll go back to my days at King David when I was a history teacher. And it was the first year where they started what was called the modified class.
Mm.
And I remember, you know, the headmaster coming in and saying, well, who would like to teach the modified class? And I thought, well, you know, let me do it. I love children. I want to help. Mm. And I put up my hand and I went into a class and there were about 15 children who were modified in inverted commas. That's the word they used. And all I did was speak slower, right? Because what did I know about dealing with these type of issues? I was trained to be a history teacher. I was never trained to deal with the difficulties You know, that are associated and come with a neurodiverse child. So how was I ever going to fix the problem?
But I love that you say, I love that you say you spoke slowly, because my son always says to me, Mom, they're speaking so fast. I can't keep up. So I love that that was just, even though you say that you weren't equipped, but instinctively, and that for me is really a mark of a true teacher, instinctively you just knew that. And I can guarantee that little talking slowly helped a lot of kids.
You know what I think helped them? Was that I cared deeply about them. Right. You can do the most amazing things as children if you get to know each and every one of them. Now, if we've got time, we'll get onto that. But I was so involved in so many different activities at King David, from the athletics team to theater to the choir to the fashion show. And the one thing that I tried to do was to get every one of the children in my modified class, I'm using that word because that's what it was called, to be involved in one of those activities. What that did is you found that every single child had a special talent. You just had to find the talent. I mean, I remember one of the boys was an outstanding athlete, right? Now, if you could get that boy to do really well on the athletics field and you could coach him and you could show that you were interested in him, all of a sudden, there was a belief that I could also do well academically.
I love that. And I'm going to hold that thought because I do want to come back to it. We're just going to a quick break and we'll be back.
101.9 High FM. One Nation, One Station. High FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You tuned into Out the Box on High FM 101.9. Let's continue the conversation about mainstreaming and inclusive education with Joseph Gerassi. So coming back to that point, Joseph, and I've got a million questions here, and I can already see we're not going to get through them. So you will need to come back. Exactly what you say is when someone believes in a child and the child understands that that person believes in them, it makes a massive difference to their attitude in school. And even on the sports field, my son is at King David. He's struggling. He's, you know, 40%, 41, I always say, is a distinction for him. But he loves school. And why? Because he loves rugby. And he's found a space to belong. So I love that when you say theater, rugby, other things that are not marks are so important for kids with barriers to learning.
It happens because when you have the barrier to learning, and I know we're going to discuss later how you kind of move from, you know, a school that deals with, they call them remedial schools, into mainstream schools. I mean, that's one of the biggest things you have to overcome is how does that child then feel part of this new environment and this new school? Now, one of the ways is to, as quickly as possible, integrate that child into the culture of that school. And there is no better way than putting them into a school play, putting them into a rugby team, because then they start to, the other kids see the talents that they have, and all of a sudden, the fact that they're not scoring distinctions, etc., does not become important anymore. They don't identify themselves as much with their academic score, but they can identify themselves in areas that they can achieve, and they also have a belief in themselves that if they work hard enough, with the right intervention, you can't be a good rugby player without a good coach. Right?
Absolutely.
You need to have a really good coach. And I like the word coach because when you're dealing with neurodiverse children specifically, the teacher becomes a coach. You're there to assist the child in so many different ways, and you need to be able to do that. So we talk really about, you know, there's three levels, and the white paper speaks about it. You've either got low-level support, which is just within an ordinary classroom. You have high-level support, which in the South African context does talk about special schools, right? And then most of the schools that we're talking, you're talking about King David, I'm talking, you know, Red Hill, those would be your moderate support schools, where you're specifically resourced and trained to support learners with moderate barriers to learning. And we can discuss, you know, what that means. But those are the type of schools, if you are going to say that you do have moderate support, you need to have a full-service school, which should have teachers that are trained in inclusive education, specifically in differentiation. Because if you've got a kid who's neurodiverse in your class, you have to know how to differentiate that class in terms of how you're teaching that class. You've got to have on-site support. You have to have access to therapists. That's really important. You have to be able to adapt your curriculum and your assessment practices. So even in our ordinary assessments, students that have accommodations will get that extra time. Whereas in the past, you know, it was only used in your final exams. Now we give it to them all the time. And you've got to have structured intervention programs. So if you're going to really call yourself a school that is a moderate support school of inclusive education, you can't just say, you know, you do it. You have to be able to see that those things are in place. It's really important.
It is really important. And it brings me to a WhatsApp where most of my WhatsApps are anonymous, and I really get it. Mm-hmm. It says, "Hi, Simone. My son is in grade 7 at a remedial school, and we're considering mainstream high school next year. Academically, he's coping, but emotionally, he's still quite immature and struggles socially. Mm-hmm. I'm terrified of making the wrong decision. How do you know if you're doing the right thing as a parent or just pushing too soon?" And coping for me is an important word, because when I say a child is coping, a child with learning barriers, they are treading water.
Mm.
And they're continuously having to tread water in order to cope.
There's no doubt about that. So it's a very difficult decision to make for parents. One of the problems that we have in South Africa is we have very, very few special needs schools. So at some point, parents are being pushed to make decisions as to which high school they're going to take their child to. I mean, there's some excellent schools that work with neurodiverse children till the end of grade 7. Very few that take it further than that. And also, as you said, while you're wanting your kid to get the best support possible academically, you also want them to integrate socially into the real world. You know, I often say that schooling is not just about teaching math and science. We are preparing children how to socialize in that real world. And that is difficult. And, you know, people that are neurodiverse are always going to, in some way or another, be treading water.
Always. Socially, academically. You know, I had this question for you, but I think it's really come up now. Is that the social aspect of school is quite brutal, and I think it's brutal even for neurotypical children. High school is a place where there are hierarchies, mm-hmm. where there are groups of kids that are accepted and groups that aren't accepted, and belonging can matter much more than marks if you get to that point of belonging. So for example, my son, as I said, loves school. He has ADHD, he has Tourette's, he has anxiety, he's profoundly dyslexic. His every day at school is a battle. And being ADHD, as you know, they're very impulsive, they can be very loud, they are very rigid in their views of things, it's very black and white, and they don't have social awareness. Mm. They can't put themselves in another person's shoes. So I do get when other children get irritated with a child like that, because to be honest, many adults get irritated with the child. So how do we protect them without saving them?
Okay, so you're absolutely correct. Just very quickly, I just wanted to get to that, your anonymous caller.
Oh, sorry. It's my working memory not very good.
I can see that she's hanging on and saying, but you didn't answer my question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think it's really important to visit a number of schools and to ask those type of questions. What interventions do you have? You know, how do children fit into this particular school? Because as we said, you ultimately are going to have to find a school for your child. It's up to you to research which will be the best fit for my child and to ask these type of questions. You will very quickly know, once you've met with a head, whether they actually have a proper program in place that will support your child, or whether this is not really going to fit my child. So that would be my suggestion. Do your research, visit a whole lot of schools while your child still is in grade six, even before they even get to grade seven, so that you can make that choice.
So before I just, let me interrupt you, I'm sorry. Alison Scott, my kids were at Bella Vista throughout their schooling, their primary schooling. And it was amazing. She came with me to the appointments with the school. And together with the headmistress or headmaster of the school, we had that conversation of what my child needed and could you supply that type of support.
Look, Alison's amazing. You know, I'll get calls from Alison who'll say to me, I believe you haven't accepted this child. I really think you've made a mistake. And I'll appreciate that because I'll say, Alison, have a conversation with me about this child. You know, so Alison knows her children really, really well. And, you know, they get a really, really good support system at Bella Vista. So, you know, when we take on a kid from Bella Vista, there is a lot of discussion that takes, you know, place beforehand. Because also schools need to make sure that they can, that they're not just promising you something. You know, that they can actually do what they say they're going to do. So, you know, that is important. But as you said, children with dyslexia often have anxiety, right? A child with ADHD will struggle socially and academically. There's no doubt about it. And a child with autism or on the autism spectrum will experience sensory overload in large classrooms. And, you know, you have to be able to deal with those type of things. So this is when the whole idea of a village becomes critical, that the conversations are held beforehand. A school should never leave parents coordinating therapists, teachers, exam boards alone, because that's when you feel, I can't breathe, right? You the first thing a school should be able to say to you is, we will partner with you in educating your child and assisting, you know, with what we do. So, I mean, you know some of the people that work at my school.
Yes.
I have them there specifically to support children in those areas. So, you know, we will have student support. We'll work alongside grade heads, academic heads, to integrate all that information. And the goal is really not to, is not fragmented intervention, but a coordinated scaffolding. You know, I've always said to parents, schools have to take you on that journey step by step by step by step and have to be there all the time with you. I go back to the whole issue of what type of school are you sending your child to? And you have to know your child and know the school. I find, you know, at Red Hill, we've got so many different children that being different is actually quite normal. Right. And I've worked in classes where I've got some of the most neurodiverse children I've ever met. They won't look you in the eye. And yet the children kind of accept them. So one of the things, once it becomes part of your culture that you do have children like that in your school, it becomes part of the children expect that. They'll see a wacky kid, and I'm calling them wacky because in the norm they are wacky. Right? They do things that are really strange. I remember having a kid, you know, that at times when they used to get, you often find neurodivergent children, specifically when on the spectrum, you'll find them under a desk. It's a safe space. I've walked into the art classroom and often the kids, they'll take drama and art. And I'll go and I'll say, what's the child doing in the corner? And the teacher will say, just leave her. That's her space.
Mm-hmm.
That's where she feels comfortable. The other kids don't give it a second thought. You know, that's whoever. I'll call her Jane for now. Jane's under the desk. She's doing a painting. Leave her.
So that's the beauty of mainstreaming into, as you said, a normal school, because it makes other children more compassionate.
Completely.
More accepting.
Completely. When I was in Australia, because that was the first time probably I came into contact with a school that was really neurodiverse. And I got to be honest, I was scared. Right, I came in as the head of a school there, and there were all these kids around that I didn't know how to interact with. And I remember saying to somebody, how do you cope with this? And she says, no, we cope fine. You know, we don't have a problem with this. It's trying to get the other kids to understand it. But the only way they'll ever understand this in life is to engage with children who are neurodiverse.
Experience it. We'll be right back after this.
Connecting our community. from Johannesburg to the world.
When I joined Howard on Chai FM recently, it reminded me once again of how important and valuable it is for our community to have a public platform like Chai FM to share important matters, to hear what the community is thinking and feeling.
This is Chai FM.
Welcome back to Chai FM 101.9. I'm Simone from Out the Box, and we're having a really important conversation about mainstreaming from remedial schools into mainstream schools that offer inclusive education. So, Joseph, just picking up from where you left off about other children developing compassion and learning, you know, about there are other types of children in the world and they have got something else to offer, which is beautiful.
So I've got a kid in my class, you know, I've seen he's a new kid. And there's no doubt there's some issue, some spectrum. And I could see the boy was sitting, he sits very much by himself, but he's a very bright boy. So the first thing that I did was I ensured that I engaged him into a team activity. Very quickly, other kids started to see that he was very bright. So I like to start on a Monday morning by doing a quiz with the kids, and we do it on one of those media cahoots. And the kids love it because I give them a prize afterwards. And because they know this kid is really bright, they all want to be on his team now, right? Because they know at the end of that, that's going to help. And so what has happened is because he's been able to show that although he's neurodiverse and thinks in a different way, he's very bright. So the kids also realize that kids that are different, it doesn't mean that they don't have the ability to achieve incredible results. It's just that in other ways. So it doesn't always deal with a child that is academically challenged. It could be a child that is socially challenged. So there's so many different ways. And, you know, some parents might be saying, but my child gets A's, but they're not fitting in. Well, it's not about how bright your child is now. It's about how they socially fit in. Some kids, and it might be your son, the way it sounds like, you know, there he might be having difficulties academically, but socially is fitting in quite well. You know,
he
in terms
is
of the rugby,
in quite well.
And he's feeling
yes.
comfortable in that environment. There's so many different areas of neurodiversity, you know, that parents are confronted with. It's all about, again, finding a place where they understand neurodiversity and that school has structures in place to support the neurodiversity of the particular child. It's about a school that understands differentiation. How do you, and that differentiation is not something that is should be seen as more work for me as the teacher, but rather as me helping a child reach their potential. We were discussing before we came into the studio that often teachers are overwhelmed by the amount of work that they actually have to do, the administrative work that they have to do. There is absolutely no doubt about that. There are schools out there where teachers hardly have a free period in the day to grab a cup of coffee, let alone prepare everything they have to prepare for their average students, plus then look at preparing things for students that are way ahead and then students who are battling. That is an enormous task.
And responsibility, especially
huge.
When kids are in grade 11 and grade 12.
Yeah, completely. So again, it's about, and unfortunately, it all has to do with resources. And financially, it is incredibly draining on parents who can't afford either those type of schools or the resources that they require. And that is because we are in a country, unfortunately, where government doesn't have the resources to support neurodiverse schools, right? And that it becomes a big problem. Because a school, for instance, like Red Hill, we're lucky we have the resources. So right up until the end of grade 3, I've got 2 teachers in every classroom. That allows teachers to have a break, that allows teachers to work together, that allows us to do a lot of group work where you can differentiate and you've got another teacher in the classroom that you can move around. So schools that can do that, that's the number one thing, because you've got 24 kids in a class. You know, and that's if you're at a private school.
Imagine, which is a lot.
But imagine you're at a government school where you've got neurodiverse children and they're sitting with 60. Oh, there's just no way that you're ever going to deal with them. It is a difficult situation.
And when you speak about those government schools, I mean, the fact that 15% of children in, was it grade 3 that I read, are able to read.
Yeah, absolutely.
For meaning. And the others, so we can understand that when they leave school, there's nothing to go to.
You know, I insist at Red Hill that we have we've got something called our Dibbles testing, right? It basically benchmarks reading ages, and I do that every second year, okay? And it's mandatory for every single child to do the testing. They don't see it as a test. Not as hectic, it's not like an IQ test. But my entire support team are involved in evaluating reading ages, specifically how children comprehend, from grade one moving through. And we monitor those children all the time. I have meetings where we discuss at-risk students. How are we dealing with at-risk students? How are they moving from one class to another class? How are they moving from one teacher to another teacher? The amount of time that we spend on deciding which is the right teacher for that child. You can't just put a child into any class when you move up. If you've got children that are neurodiverse, you might have brilliant teachers, but who just don't have the experience to deal with a child like that. And then you've got teachers that they might not be the best teachers in the country, but they have compassion and care, and that's where you want that child to be in. So there's a lot of those discussions that have to take place. You have to monitor kids all the way through. You don't want to get to grade 7 or grade 8 and then call in a parent and say, look, we've picked up a problem. The best time to deal with these problems are when these kids are 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, not when they are 14, 15, 16 and 17, because your job has just become so much more difficult. And what we would expect from schools, and that's when I go back to the white paper, is the least that we expect from schools is to be able to identify children at risk. Because if we don't identify those children, then we're doing them a huge disservice.
Right. Intervention, early intervention.
It
has to exist. And I'm blessed that my kids were, there was intervention early on. And then we come to the situation, as you said, where a grade 8 or 9 child comes into high school. One wonders how they got through primary school. Mm-hmm. And then you are sitting with a myriad of problems that now you have to not only teach them what they haven't learned, but also carry them through that year.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I say mainstreaming after remedial school is not a graduation ceremony, right? It's a transition. Okay, it's
not, I've graduated and I,
exactly. Ready means several things. Mm. Academically, can the learner manage curriculum pace with scaffolding? Emotionally, can they tolerate frustration without a collapse? Independently, can they advocate for support? So you've got to look at things like organizational skills. I was blown away by one of my teachers who's studying remedial therapy, who came to me the other day and said, Mr. Drassi, I've been studying remedial therapy. I have so much more to offer. Please give me the opportunity to offer it. I said, okay, explain to me what you're talking about. He said, I've got a child who's neurodiverse, who's just all over the place. You cannot let these children just keep going through without monitoring them and giving them organizational skills, teaching them about resilience, explaining to parents, and this is such a strange one, parents do not want accommodations. As soon as you suggest an accommodation, they see it as there's a problem with my child, not that this is a way of equaling the playing field, right? And often the biggest problems we have is with parents who just say, no, I don't want my child treated differently. And what parents have to understand is not treating your child differently. It's ensuring that they have equal opportunity. Right. And that is really important because mainstream environments are faster and they are socially more complex. Mm-hmm. And we have to understand that it's not like, well, I'm going to mainstream and all of a sudden everything's going to be perfectly. Mainstreaming is not the removal of support. It's the transfer of support into a different environment.
You know, you've hit the nail on the head and I'm smiling because when I left, and I say I because, you know, I include myself in this journey, but when we left Bella Vista, I felt like my safety net had been pulled out from under me. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how I was going to, and I'm a huge advocate for my kids, but I did actually not know how to advocate in high school because I didn't know what the expectations of high school are today.
Yeah. Look, I always say to parents, the best way to be able to do it is to ensure that the school is your ally. go in there and just say to them, I'm lost. I don't know how to operate in this environment. I need someone in the school who can be my best friend. I'm not here to criticize the school. I'm not here to tell you how you don't know what you're doing. I'm here to find a best friend. Find me a teacher who is going to be able to walk me through this.
So, which brings me to another WhatsApp. And I want to get to concessions because there's a lot to discuss there. As you say, the stigma, etc. Even the stigma around children having learning barriers, people say don't label it. I say if you don't label it, and you're not going to know what you're dealing with.
100%. I had a teacher who sat down. They realized that they had a child in the class that was dyslexic. And there was a very, very difficult conversation because someone suggested, no, don't mention it. And the teacher said, no, but I have to mention it because I am now going to have to do things differently with this child. So what I'm going to do in my next lesson is I am going to bring the children, and these are, I think, in grade 3 or grade 4. I'm going to sit them around me, and I'm going to explain to them what dyslexia is.
Demystify.
I'm going to normalize it. I'm going to say, some of you read very, very well in this class. Some of you read at a good level. Some people are still struggling, and the reason they're struggling is not because there's anything wrong with them, but because their brains work differently. They are special children. And she used that word. She said, they are special children. They see the world differently. Okay? And so at times, I'm going to do different things with these children. And when I had a conversation with the teacher afterwards and said, how did it work? She said, well, Joe, that's all they needed. All of a sudden, they were intrigued as to how this child saw things differently. And so it almost became something in the class that was quite exciting. But it normalized it. It said, we all have different abilities in this class. She took the time to say, some of you run really fast. Some of you read really fast. Some of you don't run that fast. Some of you don't read that fast. But we all belong in this class. And once that happens, all of us, it's the same with dealing with any other difference. If you're dealing with a difference of religion or difference of color, you have to normalize it. You have to explain to children that we're made up of different colors, different religions, different sexualities. Once children understand that and you demystify it, they go, okay, it's normal.
Yeah, I mean, my youngest is like an unguarded missile, I call him, and I say that with tremendous love because he's my joy. But he has a lot of things going on. But he will say to his friends, I've got ADHD, I've got dyslexia, I've got Tourette's. So if I'm doing something or saying something that you don't like, please just remember that these are the things that I'm struggling with. And once that as you said, that demystifying of what you're living with, not what you've got, but what you're living with, just creates, you know, an awareness in the other children that, look, we have to tread differently with this child. We like him. He's good at rugby. But there are these differences, which 100%. Can be difficult to manage as another child.
But I agree with you. The school has to be courageous enough to have the conversations. Okay? I think if you have a caring school, children are brought up in an environment where they do care and empathize. Okay? They will quickly understand difference. I found that kids might be a little bit more mean to each other on other things, but never on issues like this. They tend to understand it, right? They'll be mean to each other if someone said something nasty to them, and then they'll counter it. But when children understand things, I find the majority of kids, I've never, in the 10 years I've worked at Redhill, I've never had a parent come to me and say to me, kids are making fun out of my child's dyslexia. Just never had that. Right? They just seem to get on with it. They seem to understand it.
Yeah.
But I think, and that was way before I got to Redhill, I think there's just when the culture says that we are accepting, then we're accepting of everything. We can't only be accepting of race, religion, sexuality. We have to also be accepting of neurodiversity. But children need to understand that that is something that people have.
And parents need to take it on. They need to say, this is what it is. And like my middle son says, I don't have dyslexia, and I don't suffer from dyslexia. I live with dyslexia.
Sure, that's very mature.
He is, you know, he's 20 now. Yep. But I think that if parents can just step back and see that these children are gifted in so many other ways.
Completely. I've got one of my, I mean, my it's not in the same way, but I've got one of my top performers who suffers badly from stuttering, right? And sometimes if he's, when he gets on stage and he's singing or acting, there is no stutter. But in rehearsals and things like that, there are times where it takes him a long time to say what he needs to say. But he is seen in that group as a leader. Why? He's an incredible dancer. He leads all the choreography. He's been given the and he's our spirit master, right? So he leads all the war cries. Now here you've got a kid who stutters badly, but he's your spirit master. So kids will look at that and go, so he stutters.
They admire him.
And they admire him because he has been able to break through that.
Yeah.
But when he gets into a position where he is stuttering, everybody sits and waits. It's okay. You'll get there.
Patience.
But that's all. Mm. Nobody has a problem with it.
So I'm just going to come to this WhatsApp, which, you know, I want to add the caveat before I read it, that the intention is not to lay blame. I think that every parent who's advocating for their child does get to a point they feel like they're falling apart, their child is falling apart, there is a level of frustration. There are many teachers who are incredible, who are devoted and try and do everything that they can, but you do come across every now and again someone who doesn't quite understand it. So let me read it and then we can deal with it. My son has ADHD and dyslexia with processing and working memory difficulties. He struggles to copy from the board or take notes. By the time he's written one sentence, the class has already moved on. His teacher says he's lazy and unmotivated and that he needs to come to the party. But honestly, school is so hard for him. He tries, but success is rare and he comes home defeated most days. We are constantly asking for notes, summaries, slides, and collaboration with teachers who help him after school because he does not have the attention to work alone. This seems to be an ongoing problem. We have amazing and invested teachers who are completely on board, and then the odd one who is obstructive and simply gives feedback that may protect her by saying he's lazy or he's unmotivated, but actually does nothing for my child. How do I help the teacher understand that it isn't about effort? And how do I keep my child believing in himself when he keeps hearing that he's not trying hard enough?
Change the teacher.
So that's my whole issue.
Because I'm advocating very much now for the child. To change that teacher is going to take longer than that year.
Mm.
Right? You're having to change a complete way of thinking about children and about what they can do and how they can do things. That's going to take time. I would advocate that the parent goes to see the head of the school and says, look, we understand that this teacher doesn't understand this stuff. I'm sure that Mr. or Mrs. Soames is a very, very good teacher for other types of children. My child needs a teacher who understands them. Please, could you make the change? Now, if a school really cares about the child, they should know and they know their teachers. They should know that teacher is not the right teacher for this child. You know, if I've got a really good reason to change a class, I'll change the child because that child needs to be changed immediately. So that would be the first intervention. The school then has to intervene and work with that. It's not for the parent to have to now convince this teacher what to do and how to do. That's not your job. That's the school's job. Your job is to identify that this is happening. Your job as the parent is to advocate for your child and to be able to say to the school, you need to do better. Please, can you change it to another teacher?
So I hope everyone and every parent has heard that, because I think that what Joseph has said is that change needs to happen and we have to be proactive in order to support our children. We'll be right back after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chai FM 101.9, and we're talking about learning diverse children and mainstreaming into high school. Joseph, I'm so sorry. I always find that the time runs away with me and I always go over time. There's so much to talk about. And I think that your insights and your knowledge is so valuable please, will you come back to us?
Anytime. Anytime.
So to every parent listening, and to actually every child listening, you spoke about sport and how a child can succeed in that. And it's just ironic, not ironic if that's the wrong word, but I chose a quote today by John Wooden. He was one of the greatest basketball coaches of all time. And he believed that success was built on character, hard work, integrity, teamwork, and self-discipline. And for him, it was never about the scoreboard, but becoming your best self. So I'll leave you with this powerful reminder. Do not let what you cannot do interfere with what you can do. Joseph, one sentence. Mm-hmm. What would you tell a parent listening now?
I would say to any parent that's out there, believe in your child. Understand that if your child is neurodiverse, that is not a problem. In many respects, it's an advantage because they see the world in a different way. You're going to have to be there to advocate for them. There's no getting out of it. Find the right school for your child and partner with that school. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, I have to say that the children that have been most memorable in my mind were children that were different, you know, not the norm. Mm. The norm go through one child after the other. It's those special children that, you know, that often are the children that leave a place in your heart. And I'll just end on this. I had a parent that wrote to me, and I'll never forget this because I learned it almost off by heart. They said to me, thank you for not seeing our child as being a child with issues, but look, seeing the potential in our child. And I think that's exactly what you've said. We can always harp on the issues, but if you see the potential in the child, you will concentrate on that and ensure that you don't see the child as being a problem, but rather a child, you know, that has so much that they can give back if we give them the opportunity to do so.
And the child will see that, which is
absolutely
paramount. So I'm leaving you with the song Unwritten by Natasha Bedingfeld, and it just felt so apt for our discussion today. And let me just say, I'm changing my tagline just a little for today. So Out the Box on 101.9 High FM is for minds that don't fit the mold and the hearts that love them. I'll speak to you next time. Thank you, Joseph, and we have to leave you now.